Welcome to Mint, a unique look into how the creators of today are building the communities of tomorrow by harnessing the power of Web3. I'm your host, Adam Levy, and let's kick off this episode by giving some love to our five NFT sponsors. They are Coinvise, Poap, Celo, Social Stack, and PrimeDAO. First off, on Coinvise, you can create a personal or community-owned social token on Ethereum. Coinvise also helps you create incentives through token rewards and bounties, NFT business models, and bot integrations for Discord. Discover more by visiting coinvise.co today. Next up, we have Poap, or short for Proof of Attendance Protocol, who enables a novel way of creating one's life diary. Leveraging NFT technology, Poap facilitates an easy way to mint non-fungible tokens related to meaningful events. It's frequently used in crypto-native communities, and now it's starting to create NFT collectors in the mainstream too. Collect or launch your own Poap today by visiting poap.xyz. Next up, we have Social Stack, a platform for communities, brands, and creators to build mission-driven social token economies. Offering an easy-to-use, non-custodial wallet with a suite of open-source community engagement tools, Social Stack makes it simple to bring your community into Web3 and be a part of creating an open-source, gratitude-driven future for social tokens. Create a free social token wallet, discover mission-driven social token communities, or apply to launch your own token on Social Stack by visiting socialstack.co today. Next up, we have Celo. Are you looking for an ecosystem of dApps, currencies, and tokens that can connect you with people no matter their device, carrier, or country? Well, say hello to Celo, a mobile-first platform that makes crypto dApps and payments accessible to anyone with a mobile phone. Celo supports thousands of projects from builders, developers, and artists who every day build applications and issue tokens from all over the world. Visit celo.org today to learn more. And last but not least, we have PrimeDAO, a collective of DeFi builders and DAO veterans attempting to turn DeFi into a more cooperative ecosystem by creating DAO-to-DAO interactions. The first solution to go live is PrimeLaunch, a launchpad experience for DAOs built in collaboration with Balancer. If you plan on launching a DAO, head over to prime.xyz to access a network of partners and tools that will jumpstart your DAO development today. This episode welcomes Ruben Bremenathan, an expert on all things crypto law, product management, fund management, and more. Having worked at Coinbase from 2015 to 2017, Ruben has seen the industry evolve at a rate in which many don't have purview. Now, he's building IDEO Colab for collaborative impact, where he and his team connect organizations to shape technology's impact on the world. In this episode, we talk about JPEG Summer, securities laws regarding fractional NFTs, what opportunities in the space most excite him, how NFTs are introducing the mainstream into crypto, NFT consumer applications, what will eat Web3, and so much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Ruben, welcome. Welcome to Mint. How you doing, man?
Doing great. Thanks, Adam. Great to be here.
Yeah, man. It's good to have you on. I've been wanting to have you on for some time now, considering your deep expertise in the space. So, what a pleasure. Let's just get started. Give me a quick background on yourself. Who are you? What were you doing before crypto, and kind of where are you now?
I almost can't remember what I was doing before crypto. It feels like a lifetime. I've been around since about 2013. I was a lawyer by training and working in a big law firm, found out about Bitcoin through some friends, got deeper and deeper into it, ended up leaving that big law firm to start a small law firm focused on Bitcoin in Australia. It was 2014. And through that, just kind of got deeper and deeper. I joined Coinbase in 2015 as one of the first lawyers there. Also did a bunch of product management work at Coinbase and started some new businesses, including the index fund there. And through that all realized, law was my profession and the set of skills that I had, but crypto became my passion. And so I ended up leaving Coinbase in 2019 to start working with companies deeper in the space in DeFi and more recently NFTs, social tokens, and using my regulatory and legal background to help solve some problems at those earlier stages, help founders build, navigate some of those tricky issues. And through that, got connected with the team at IDEO. And so now I'm full-time investing with IDEO, but also, we just spend a lot of time with the companies we work with and solving some of those hard problems at early stages.
Yeah. I think one thing I really like about your story is obviously getting started at Coinbase, which I'm curious, how has that kind of shaped your career in crypto, getting started at like one of the best firms to work at in the space?
It was amazing. It was an incredible journey, a lot of ups and downs. And, you know, living through that hyper growth and seeing those cycles in crypto is definitely, it gives you perspective. Every time that there's something new or exciting or traumatic happens, I think our tolerance for chaos is much higher because, you know, kind of lived through that. In those early days at Coinbase, the crew there was incredible, just some phenomenal people to work with, and to kind of have been there was just a blessing. And then to have that experience, as I said, through those cycles is really set up a lot of former Coinbase folks to go out and go on to do even greater things.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, the first person that comes to mind is Antonio from DYDX. You also have a few people that kind of bridged from Coinbase, started their own funds. And it's cool to kind of see your journey and helping so many founders solve really critical, whether it be regulatory problems, tokenomic problems, right? What part of like the crypto sphere, because you've dabbled, you've also consulted, you've also launched your own social token. Throughout every experience, what have you found to be like the most rewarding one so far? Like, what have you enjoyed doing the most?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what I enjoy most is just being there alongside the builders, the folks figuring out the new stuff. And that's in my career, that's been the one thing that I think I've done right, is I've always managed to seek out the people finding and building the new stuff. And so for me, it's kind of, being there alongside them, whether it's a tricky regulatory issue, hard decision around, you know, the right move for communities, some, you know, product related stuff as well. I think that just having been around long enough, I've been able to help a bunch of people. And honestly, through that, I learn as well. And I feel like, the companies that I've advised, I've learned as much from them as they have from me. So that's just such a rewarding thing about building new stuff in uncertain territory together.
Yeah, for sure. I want to pivot kind of to where we are right now in the marketplace. People are coining it as JPEG summer. Okay. Obviously, we have the cool cats, the Bored Apes, the punks, record level transaction volume across OpenSea and all these NFT marketplaces. And it's kind of like NFTs are having their moment of fame again, right? How do you feel about everything that's happening about JPEG summer?
Yeah, don't forget the penguins and the monster blocks and everything else as well.
Everything else. I feel like if I were to name everything, we'd just be going on for like 20 minutes.
For sure. You know, it does have some parallels with DeFi summer. Just that euphoria where so many new people are coming into the space and coming in for new reasons. You know, the for so long, people only got into crypto through Bitcoin, through that digital gold narrative. And then even after that, you know, we had all the other, you know, coins at the peak of the 2017 cycle. We had Ethereum. And then DeFi summer really peaked because people came into crypto for DeFi, not just for, a decentralized digital gold asset, but because of the new things that were being built, the new ideas of the borrowing and lending and decentralized exchange protocols, yield farming, all these things, people came in for different reasons. And we're seeing that again in a different flavor now, which is even more powerful because as it turns out, more people care about culture and art and communities and sport and gaming than do about finance, right? So there's a new reason that people are getting into crypto, and that's what's most exciting, to see new people who wouldn't have really gotten into Bitcoin or Ethereum or any other crypto for crypto's sake. They're getting in for the sake of the content and the communities and the new networks that are being formed of people. So I think, you know, you can kind of hone in on any individual NFT project. You can see the explosion of punks, obviously. You can look at PartyDAO just recently and the stuff that's been built there. Right. Fractionalized NFTs. All of these are indications that there is demand from normies to come into crypto for different reasons.
Yeah, let alone like yesterday, okay, OpenSea's transaction volume. This is, for those who are wondering, right now it's August 13th. So August 12th, okay, Thursday, August 12th, right? I think OpenSea had about like what, $60 million in transaction volume that same day, right? Their percentage is about what, 2.5% on all of that. So they're obviously thriving. 30-person team just raised at $100 million valuation. And now you're talking about like the normies and how it's kind of becoming more of a mainstream, even though we're not mainstream yet, right? But it's like steps. We're taking steps towards that. And we're seeing a zoo of NFTs and all these characters. I guess my question to you is like, one, how sustainable is that? All these profile pictures, okay? And two, do you think it's a good like intro for new people to come into crypto and to experiment like this type of bubble, this type of chaos, this type of casino? What do you think about that?
Yeah, so answering the second question first, I think yes. I think there's obviously, you know, some danger in a lot of like the frothy, bubbly price speculation stuff. But I think that's always been the way in crypto. What attracts people is something that's hot, that attracts attention, and necessarily that means there's price speculation, because everything in crypto is inherently financial or financializable. So that just means that speculation is a measure of the attention coming in. And like I was saying, it's really exciting that people are coming in for a lot of the cultural and art reasons as well. So it's just another on-ramp into crypto. And I think that one of the things we've been talking about for a long, long time is how do we bring crypto to mainstream? But really the question that we need to be asking is how do we bring the mainstream to crypto? And NFTs have proven that this is one pathway. And of course, it's janky to set up MetaMask and secure your private key and figure out gas and all that stuff. But people are doing it, and people are doing it because they want to be a part of crypto and they want to be a part of the space. So that's not to say that, you know, we can disregard UI or the you know, making it easier for people to kind of onboard. But the reality has always been in crypto that people find a way because they want the product so much. So as to how sustainable it is, that's a great question. I think like in anything crypto, there's going to be just more and more peaks and troughs and volatility. But, you know, there was a great post by Fred Wilson again this week that whether this, you know, this version of NFTs is the exact version of the future, that's up for debate. But it's beyond debate now that the NFTs are going to power Web3 and the internet of the future, what the internet was always supposed to be.
Yeah, one thing that I see increasingly happen is, well, it's obvious that these NFTs, they have market value. Obviously, people are trading them, right? Making money from them, flipping them, whatever, raising the floor, sweeping them, all these different tactics to kind of manipulate the market. But at the end of the day, the big bet here is every form of media is going to end up becoming an NFT, right? It's going to have a level of ownership. Do you agree or disagree with that, for starters?
100% agree.
Okay, go ahead.
Every form of media, including every content, every piece of content, every post, every story, every fleet, every like.
Everything.
Yeah. And whether it's specifically an NFT or not, it's an on-chain action that's going to be cataloged, recognized, and available to form your social profile in the future.
So, okay, we both agree on that. I think many people also agree on that concept, but right now, the tools in the onboarding products that are in place from MetaMask to all these alternative crypto wallets, they don't play on that narrative. Right now, they're focused on onboarding users to play and mess around with ERC-20s, right? The second you open a wallet, specifically MetaMask, who focuses on the Chrome extension, you have all your ERC-20s. You don't really see your NFTs, even though they do store them. But so the onboarding process on getting people to consume these NFTs, these media files, whether they be land rights, whether they be future PDFs, whether they be MP3s from an NFT album or an NFT film, that's not in place right now to actually enjoy and consume, right? Have you seen like companies kind of approach that problem? What do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a huge area of opportunity to build products that let users really dive in there. I still think that it's not the most pressing problem. I think because people are still finding their way into crypto because they want the product, as janky as it is. And I kind of look at more things like security, you know, this, especially at the user end. I think that's one thing that wallets could really focus on and do better in addition to, you know, improve user experience. But yeah, for sure, we're going to see new wallet infrastructure. We're going to see probably an evolution of like the wallet to the profile. And we think about that a lot at IDEO, that the wallet is a very financial lens to look through the way you interact with cryptocurrency. And like you say, you know, when if for many people the primary action is to do with NFTs, is to do with content rather than finance, then that experience should look different. But again, it comes down to that, you know, secure private key management. And then how do you translate that into your collection, your profile, your gallery, your display? So there's going to be a few different ways to approach that, whether it's, you know, a more lightweight wallet that kind of plugs into more fully featured galleries or metaverses or spaces, or something all in one. Yeah, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Why are you so excited about the security side? What is it about it that like gets you going?
I would say I'm not thrilled by it. It's just something that needs to happen, both at the protocol level, the contract level, and at the user level. I think that's one thing. I mean, you know, you can train or you can educate people to go through the clicks and the stages to send and bid and all that stuff. But if they haven't backed up their private keys in a secure way, right, then that's the fundamental problem. So I think that, you know, it's great that the hardware wallet space is evolving. It's great that the user education is evolving. But I would say that's still the main area of concern, rather than just, you know, a nicer user flow.
Yeah. When I think of crypto and securities, obviously you have a bunch of examples that come to mind, but one that excites me the most, that's slowly picking up more traction, is how the use of NFTs merge with the music industry. Okay. And it's obviously an ongoing conversation for years now. A few people come to mind, like Justin Blau or DJ Three Lau, right? And a bunch of others at the moment, right? But this concept of basically being able to fundraise through your audience, through your fans, without going through per se KYC, right? And being able to own a certain dividend from royalty distribution through those NFTs, if you fractionalize a song, for example, right? Those level of like, that's what I think about when I think of securities. Obviously, there's a bunch of other categories, a bunch of other examples, but this is like a pressing use case that many are trying to make happen and bring to life, but struggle because of the SEC component. Like, nobody wants to be an example of the SEC, right? I remember we saw this in 2017 when you had DJs like DJ Khaled promoting ICOs. They got a slap on the wrist by the SEC. This NFT thing is like the next progression. When artists are kind of, and I only bring up artists because a lot of our audience are creators, musicians, artists, are right? Okay, so when people are trying to like experiment with the NFT route and trying to take it one step further beyond just selling a JPEG or an MP3 file and really allow their fans to kind of go on their journey with them financially, how can they do that today without kind of like crossing the red flags of the SEC?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, music is a great example of an industry with very entrenched, opaque power structures that don't always serve the artists. In fact, most of the time they don't. And, you know, again, it's rife for disruption, where we now have a technology which enables artists and creators to engage directly with their fans, directly with their communities, whether that's through music as content, whether it's through NFTs or other kinds of multimedia that, you know, they want to sell or give away or share with their communities. You know, we're going to see actual on-chain tokenized royalties. That's coming. You know, it's just a matter of time. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be as disruptive to that industry as the internet was to the media, to the press, to Hollywood. I think that, you know, this is the true promise of Web3, that this technology is here. What that means in the short term is that there's still a lot of resistance from the traditional legal structures to anything different. So, you know, your example is a great one. What if an artist wants to share their upside with their community? What if they want to take them on the journey? There's still limited ways in which you can do that. One example which I was really proud of because I worked on was the RAC token. And what we did for RAC was we actually did an airdrop of his token to all of his past supporters. So went back and looked at people who had supported him through Patreon, people who had been to one of his shows, bought merch, Bandcamp, like all of the other ways that he'd built this community around him, folks that had supported him in the past. And he was able to give back to them through the token. So it wasn't an ICO, it wasn't a sale, it was just given away. And he kind of aligned himself with his community that way. And then going forward, you know, those tokens can be used for other incentives, for you know, collaborations, or people in the community participating and supporting him. You know, token gated access, there's a bunch of stuff you can do. But I think that the long story short is, when it comes to a creator or an artist actually giving back to their community, that's a much more fundamentally like less risky way than if they're extracting value from their community. So we could do a whole session on securities law and the Howey test, but the TLDR is, I think that kind of aligns nicely.
Yeah. So what you're explaining or like describing, from what I'm understanding, is the utility component behind RAC's token, the access component, right? And is that kind of like more where you're leaning towards?
It's a little bit about utility, but it's also about what the community expects and what they you know, have to give up to participate in it. So if you're asking them to buy your tokens from you, that starts to look like an ICO. If you're giving them tokens, or you're letting them earn tokens, or you're kind of you know, creating an economy where everyone shares in that value, that's much less likely to be a security. And I've written a little bit about this and some of the other things you can do within the community to make it about sharing the value rather than extracting the value.
Fascinating. Very, very fascinating. And you talk about token gated content, and this is something that I'm personally very excited about that we haven't seen kind of experimented with to the fullest extent. I think the most prevalent example, when a listener is thinking about token gated content, what that means is when you buy a Bored Ape, you have the bathroom that you can unlock, and you have this shared canvas that everybody can contribute to a pixel of art to the whiteboard, right? Every 2-15 minutes, whatever the time interval is. But what other forms of like token gated content have you seen that's quite exciting that you think other creators can kind of implement or start tinkering with in their communities?
Yeah, there are plenty of examples of, you know, token gated Discords or Telegram channels or forums, streams. All this stuff is going to be token gated. That's not to say that, you know, that's the only model, but it is one. You know, especially for creators with a large audience, you know, being on the inside, feeling like you're part of the inner circle, I think can be really valuable for those token holders. But there's also, again, NFTs being, you know, inherently public by default, and that content being public, and the more that content is shared and referenced, you know, the more valuable it becomes. So that is kind of the other end of the spectrum. So for a creator, it's important to think really, really carefully about what you want to gate, what experience you want to create for your inner circle of fans and supporters, and then what you want to make public, and the different trade-offs between those two models.
Yeah. I think you're right. All these Collabland bots, these CoinVise bots, these PoWAP bots, right? All these things contributing, whether you've participated some at one point in time in a community, and what that allows you to access. It's a very powerful thing that we see more in like Web 2 and a mass level. For example, like subscription, right? If you subscribe to an OnlyFans account, you get access to certain perks, right? And if you upgrade, there's tiers to it, which is a very known model, but now it's integrating it on the token front, right? One thing I want to talk to you about is this infrastructure bill that came out recently that made headwinds across crypto Twitter, right? For those who don't understand it, can you give us a quick brief of what was kind of driving people crazy? And how do you feel about the infrastructure bill and kind of where it stands right now?
Yeah, first of all, the biggest takeaway is that the crypto lobby, the folks that are lobbying for, you know, fair and reasonable regulation for crypto, they're super important. Donate to Coin Center, support Blockchain Association. These folks are doing great work. And what they were able to do was take this bill, this infrastructure bill, which is about a fundamental, like, bunch of other stuff in the economy. But there was an amendment, a part of the bill, which would treat basically everyone in crypto as a broker. And what the intention of the bill is, was to make sure that the people who are actually brokers, Coinbase, other exchanges, centralized custodians, requiring them to report on user transactions, just like every broker in the US has to do. And no one was disputing that. But the problem was the bill was so widely drafted that it could have included miners, validators, people who had deployed smart contracts or running DEXs, Lightning operators, basically anyone who touched a crypto transaction. It would make them into a broker, which would mean that they had a responsibility to report the identity, the cost basis, all this stuff around transactions that they simply don't have access to, and they're not in a position to do that. So I tweeted that it's actually not existential for crypto, right? Crypto itself, it doesn't care. The actual up, you know, the function of these networks doesn't really get impeded by these folks having to do more compliance. But it's a huge problem for the crypto industry in the US. It would force a lot of these operations offshore, or it would mean that it's simply not practical to run, you know, a node or a validator from within the US in a way that people offshore could easily get around. It's trivial. So we're still in a stage where that might go through. And then there's a few more stages after that in terms of whether the Treasury and IRS would actually seek to enforce that against people who write contracts or simply, you know, validate. But it's just really bad policy, and it was a shame to see it rush through so quickly.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think it obviously stirred a lot of chaos across crypto Twitter. And I called my senator, and I read that script and did that whole process. And my next question to you is, like, how does this affect creators in that future vision of what crypto wants the creator economy to become? How does that, like, if that went underneath the rug in that past, right? Thankfully, it got the attention of people who care about crypto and believe in it wholeheartedly beyond just the transactional component. But what does this mean for the future of, like, the creator economy?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think this specifically, even in the broadest interpretation, shouldn't include creators who are just selling NFTs or who are, you know, part of communities or running tokenized communities. But the broader issue of regulation, I think, again, it comes back to securities law. Can you launch a token? Can you launch, you know, a brand or fan or community token without running afoul of the securities laws? You know, my take in general is that the creators are the folks who have, you know, really been historically underpaid for the work, the content they create, the communities and that they build. And, you know, there is a narrative around crypto enabling and empowering creators. And it's a way that for the first time, they're actually able to realize the value of the content, the work that they produce. And so there's a stronger argument, you know, for these folks to be able to monetize than there is for example, you know, like a 2017 ICO that's just trying to pump its bags. That's not to say it's going to be smooth sailing. There's probably going to be still a lot of gray area around social tokens. But to me, at least, there is a stronger narrative for creators. And it, like anything in crypto, the principle of decentralization and community contribution actually aligns pretty well with the securities law. The more decentralized your community is, the more different participants you have that are adding value, that are creating content, the less likely it is that your token is going to be a security. If you're just one person or brand or team that's doing everything, that's actually more likely to make your token a security because you are centralized, you're the one responsible for adding the value, and the rest of the token holders are more passive. So the more active, more engaged, collaborative your community is, the less likely you are for your token to be a security.
Which is like the end goal for any community, right? The activity, the engagement, that level of collaboration, like everybody should be striving for that. So you just naturally align with kind of drifting towards the green area. And by the way, none of this is like legal advice. None of this is financial advice. This is all commentary, right? And I think it's important to say that because I don't want people like listening to this episode and like taking notes. All right, guys, this is what we need to do in the next team meeting, you know, and definitely go get your own legal advice. But I think, Ruben, because you have such like in-depth experience and such early experience in the space, you've seen a lot of things unfold. You've seen a lot of things go south and go north and things win, things lose. And I think it's important to hear your perspective despite the legal advice that people should get, right? And I love that component that you're saying people need to build towards that level of community, that level of collaboration, because again, it's already ingrained with where people should go. One thing that sparked an insane excitement from the community level on crypto Twitter is the essence of fractionalization. Okay. That took headwinds across crypto Twitter. And I know SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce spoke at the Security Token Summit, April or May. And she basically said, like, people need to be really careful with how they interact with NFTs, and that fractional NFTs could kind of align on the security side of things. Some lawyers that I've spoke to, they say stay away from fractionalization. Others said there's still gray areas that people can tinker with. How do you feel about everything that's happening around fractionalization and kind of where they clash in the legal system?
Yeah, there's definitely still a gray area. Having said that, I think a fractionalized NFT is in general less likely to be a security than most ERC-20 tokens. And the reason for that is you're buying a part of a whole, and the whole is the content, is the NFT, it's the punk, it's the ape, it's whatever. And your expectation of profit, and this is the Howey test, but you're buying into this collectible, this original, and you might speculate on the value of that original, but that's much different to speculating on the value of a protocol or of a new asset that has a central team building. And I've always thought that an NFT in general, your expectation of profit is due to the rarity or the demand for that asset, for that piece of content, rather than the efforts of any other one person. So it's not to say that it's all in the clear, but I think around, and again, back to this narrative of art and design and culture and content, this is simply the monetization of stuff that hasn't been able to be monetized on the internet very effectively before. And that's very different to ICOs and pump and dumps and rug pulls.
Yeah, let me bring another side to the story for a minute, okay? Obviously, art is a thing that existed way well before NFTs, and the concept of tinkering with buying fractional shares of physical art has been a thing that people have done, and there's companies that do that. I'm blanking out on which one is the main one, but a different lawyer that I spoke to recently brought up this example of, the essence of fractionalizing Picasso, right? A physical Picasso that already exists. It's just that investors need to go through KYC and they need to report those fractions to the SEC and get that whole process like legally figured out. Not everyone can just buy a fraction. And, it really got me thinking, like, if artists want to tinker with fractionalizing an album, right? And their intellectual property that they own and they created, they want to share that with either a select few or a large group and fractionalize and sell it. Like, there's a lot of things in place that people just keep getting and running into, like, these walls of, like, okay, there's a real world example of someone needs to register with the SEC, right, to fractionalize this Picasso. But then you have all these like ERC-20s that are being fractionalized for this punk. Like, where do people go? What do people do? How do people approach this? And the fact that you're telling me right now it's less likely to be a security is an interesting take. Why is it from the real world example, it is a security, but from the digital world example, it's not?
Well, it comes back to investor protection at its fundamental level. If you fractionalize the Picasso, someone's got to hold the original. It's got to be in a vault somewhere. They're responsible for, that centralized point of custody. And yeah, you want to make sure that actually exists and it's not a scam. But that's very different to a fractionalized NFT. Anyone can verify instantly that it exists. Obviously, it's non-custodial. Those same kind of risks are not present in a fractionalized NFT in the same way that a fractionalized real world asset is. And I think that, there is certainly a possibility that a fractionalized NFT could be a security if the way it's marketed is marketed like an investment that's going to have value added because there's going to be, things built on top of it or whatever. But I think if we live in a world where an artist can't sell an original NFT fractionalized from the start, then that's a huge problem. Why shouldn't an artist be able to sell 100 fractionalized NFTs as opposed to one original? The one original is clearly not a security. It's a piece of art. So if we live in that world, I think we have a problem. I don't think we're there yet. I think that's kind of the worst case outcome. But if you think about it like that, why should a creator not be able to sell the work in 1,000 pieces rather than one piece? It's the same outcome.
Yeah. I think this is also an interesting question from a social token point of view. And obviously, fractionalizing enables more liquidity for illiquid assets, right? And we saw that very prevalent through the punk, the living dead punk, right? From blinking on the name. And I know like this also ties into your ethos and your belief of fair launches. I know you're involved with Fair Launch Capital. And should creators be approaching their token sales, their NFT sales from a fair launch point of view, or should they be approaching it from like doing a private raise as well before releasing it and publishing it to the community to get involved?
Yeah, it's a great question. We started Fair Launch Capital last summer at the height of DeFi summer because there was an opportunity, and there still is, for people to raise funds in different ways, whether they raise from the community, whether they raise from private backers, or whether they don't raise at all. And they're still, you know, uniquely, the things that are uniquely enabled by crypto, blockchains are kind of self-sustaining in the way that they kind of pull capital, and then that capital gets allocated to projects within that ecosystem. So we definitely have seen that capital kind of recycled, those gains recycled into new projects. As for artists, I think that, again, you know, for so long they haven't been able to really realize the value of their work. So I don't think we should have an expectation for artists to kind of give away their work for free. But you know, there's definitely opportunities if that's what they want. If they want to give something back to their community, they can give away tokens, they can give away NFTs. Some interesting models where, you know, there's rather than a full, you know, unlimited open edition, there's one of X, but then there's, you know, another kind of, you know, replica of that that's its own edition that gets given away, so that the folks that can afford to bid on the original or the one of 10 or the fractionalized one of 100 do that, but other fans can still have kind of like a derivative or a print, the equivalent of a print of the original that they can own as well. So there's so many new frameworks and new possibilities that can be explored. I think that's one of the most exciting things.
I want to ask you a couple more questions before I let you go. Your time at IDEO Collab, okay? Is it collab or collab?
Yeah, we say collab. It's okay. In there in the name. It's collaboration. Okay. We like to invest collaboratively. We like to work collaboratively. We put that in the name for a reason.
Okay. So you obviously see a lot of like, you guys see a lot of projects, right? A lot of deal flow. And from your point of view, what are some of like the more pressing issues in crypto that have yet to be solved?
Yeah, I think like I mentioned at the start, security at all levels is still such a huge one. So we've been investing in some great projects in the infrastructure space in terms of security audits, bug bounties, insurance, and we'd love to see more in the user experience space as well. So those, I guess, are probably number one. And then again, like as always, still more efforts to kind of bring mainstream users into crypto. Having said that, I think, you know, the NFT summer is proving that people are coming in. I think now, you know, it's almost like we do look still for the pain points. We look for the things that are really painful for builders, entrepreneurs, users, and solving them. But we also just see this like massive blue ocean of new opportunities. And we love talking to founders who have a big vision of how things will look in 3 and 5 and 10 years. And so they also, you know, they're also working on something that's an immediate pain point. One example is everything around DAOs. So DAOs to run effectively like traditional businesses, they need, you know, HR and payroll and operations and treasury management and accounting that simply doesn't exist. And those tools need to exist right now. So that's one that's clearly a pain point. On the investing side, you know, we spun out Syndicate Protocol, which is really focused on making it easy for people to spin up any kind of collective investment vehicle on chain or off chain. So those are some examples of pain points. But on the other side, you know, looking at things that are happening in the NFT space, seeing what happened with Party DAO and you know, enabled by the auction house that Zora built, that's like truly new primitives and new markets that are coming.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it unravel. Final question for you, Kay. I know you're a big fan of the development of the internet and the rise of like the transition from Web 2 to Web 3. You're very vocal about that. And one thing that I like to ask guests on the show is kind of like pick their brain on the stages of the development of the internet. So Web 1 was very much read-only, right? Web 2 made that transition in creating social graphs, social networks, making friends online. Web 3 is surrounded around this primitive of internet money, right? Ownership, decentralization. And they're each like collectively eating one another. So Web 2 ate at Web 1. Web 3 is argued to eat Web 2. What do you think is going to eat Web 3?
Nice. Yeah, huge question. I honestly haven't thought about it. I think we're still many years away from the full Web 3 vision, although we're starting on that pathway now. And the thing about Web 3 is that, you know, when people own their own content and data, they can choose which platforms to use. They can choose where to share it and how it will be surfaced, but they still own it. And at the same time, they own the platforms that they're using. So community ownership is, we believe, fundamental to Web3, the ability for users to own and control and have a say in where the direction of those platforms goes. So I guess after that, you can kind of extrapolate and see basically, you know, new platforms being built by communities rather than by centralized teams, the tooling just being there from day one, the pseudonymous economy being really part of Web3, and just, you know, enabling anyone anywhere to contribute, to start something, to contribute to something else, no matter where they are, what they look like, which regime they live under. I think that's really where we're heading. And that's one of the most exciting things about Web3.
Yeah. And part of that, every single thing that you just mentioned is with the intention of bringing everything on chain, right? Well, what happens when everything is on chain? What risks does that kind of propose? And I think that kind of ties into what will eat Web3. Once all that data is on chain, how do you, like, what comes after that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's just an AI revolution where the bots are so much more effective at interacting with the chains than humans are. And yeah, maybe that's when we kind of transcend into the cloud or the matrix or whichever utopian or dystopian future you want to believe in. But yeah, I think that at that point, society looks much, much, much different, both in terms of how we all participate in the economy and then how governments and traditionally large corporations, like the role that they play, will obviously look very different as well. So that's a deep future episode, but I can see that, you know, the seeds are already planted.
I think that's a perfect place to end off. Ruben, thank you so much for being on Mint. Before I let you go, quickly plug yourself, where we can find you and everything that you're working on.
Thanks so much, Adam. It's been amazing. I'm on Twitter @BrahmaNathan. Hit me up. My DMs are open anytime.